Hi everyone, welcome back to Remember What's Next. Rabbi Ken Spiro, thanks for joining us from Jerusalem.
Always a pleasure. Just back from South Africa.
How was South Africa?
South Africa was nice. They're going into their summer now. And yeah, the Jewish community, like everywhere else, is definitely, as we say in Yiddish, on spilkas. There are people who are very uncomfortable. I was there for 2 weekends. The first Shabbat, they had a huge march of like pro-Hamas march. The government of South Africa is very anti-Israel, and they had a big pro-Hamas march through the Jewish neighborhoods. Like it would be the equivalent of walking through Miami or, Rest Rogers Park in Chicago. So everyone was kind of hiding inside, scared. So people are very, very uncomfortable in a way that they have never been since, like, never, never, not in the diaspora. Not, I mean, okay, Jews living in Germany and under German occupation may have been, but I don't think Westerners have had this experience in a century plus, anything like this.
Yeah, definitely we are feeling it even here in boring old Canada and in Toronto. We are definitely feeling a certain type of erasure of our experience as Jews and threat, coming with that is still lots of police cars around our schools and shuls and it feels needed. So it's definitely a we are in a new world, unfortunately, but also possibly fortunately. So today what we wanted to do is try to bust up a few myths and facts. I think there's so much information going around. Somebody yesterday was saying, the difference between what was going on in the 1930s pre-Holocaust and what's going on now, even though the levels of anti-Semitism are similar, in 1930s you could hide from the news. Now literally everything is on your phone, it's on your screen, it's on your television. You cannot hide from what is going on, and it is constantly in your face. And so, we're really experiencing a type of anti-Semitism that you cannot run from, even in your own consciousness, in your own mind, and in your own home, that perhaps wasn't necessarily present in the same way in the 1930s. So I thought we would maybe we discuss talking about some of the big topics that people are onto. So one of the things I think that I see people struggling with the most, both to muster a response to, but also to be able to understand for themselves, is this question of Jewish indigeneity to the land. We've addressed it over multiple episodes, but I think there is this very strong narrative out there that white European Jews came and pushed the Arabs out of what is now called Israel, and we are colonizers, and that's why this is an unjust war. So, what's the myth? What's the fact? How do we respond to that? What do we need to know?
Right. So we have to begin with understanding that Jews were, or people are confused, even Jews, that we are both a religion and a people. We have a kind of, they're inseparable. Even if you don't live in Israel, you're still a Jew. And even if you're not observant and live in Israel, you're still, So that's number one, that we're a nation. We have a land, language, and a history. And we're one of the oldest surviving nations on the planet Earth, by the way. There's probably no one on the planet Earth. Probably no one, literally, not even the Chinese, who can say literally for 3,000 years plus that they're the same people, with obviously, many people have joined the Jewish people and a lot have left, but the core of who we are, this is even proven genetically, we are the same people living in the same country with the same language, with the same faith, with the same capital, which is the big one. Any of the Chinese have that one. They have Nanking and Beijing. I don't think there's any people on the planet Earth who make that claim. So just because we didn't have a state for many thousands of years, not because of what we chose, because what would happen to a circumstance, doesn't mean that we appear suddenly in the world as a modern entity. Our connection to the land of Israel goes back about 3,000 years. And there was always Jews in the land of Israel, even when we didn't have a state, which we didn't have for 2,000 years. And that's where the only people who could claim to be more indigenous to the land of Israel than us would be Canaanites. We don't hide that. It's right there in the Bible. That goes back, but that goes back, we're talking about 3,000 plus years, more than 3,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. When the Jews entered the land of Israel and conquered it, there's some Canaanites remained, by the way, afterwards. You could claim the biblical Jews had no right to take Israel from the Canaanites, but they're no longer allowed to make that claim themselves. So if you could find a Canaanite, they were the people who could possibly make an alternative claim that wasn't fair what happened to them. But by the way, the whole history of the world is people living in places today that they're not indigenous to. America and right. Canada are classic examples of that, unless you could find, you know, unless you're an indigenous native indigenous person in one of those places. So that's pretty much the situation everywhere. It's not unique to the Jewish people. But what people don't understand is A, we're a nation. B, we've been there thousands of years. C, we never left. We didn't have political control over our homeland for a long time, but that doesn't rob you of your right to be there. And also the colonizers, the Arabs, you know, Palestinians, which is a modern identity, it doesn't exist. There's no Arab Palestinian identity before the mid 1960s. Okay.
So I have a question about that. I have a question about that, because one of the things that I have statements I've heard put out there are the Palestinians are the Canaanites. Do we have any proof of that whatsoever? Is there any historical evidence to support that?
Well, they say the Philistines, because that's where the name Palestine comes from.
Right.
The Philistines. So the Philistines are not indigenous to Israel either. They came here a long time ago, too. They're around the time of Abraham. They're seafaring people who travel across the Mediterranean and settle on the coast. They disappear. By the way, we're fighting with them throughout the Bible. We don't destroy them, but they disappear at the time of the Assyrian conquest of the land of Israel about 2,500 years ago. The irony of all of this is that the term Palestinian, which was pretty much the Palestinian identity, was only used by Jews until 1948, living in what is today Israel. They call themselves Palestinian Jews. The Arabs call themselves Arabs. But the term Syro-Palestina, which was a Roman term applied to the subjugated Jewish people in the early second century after the biggest revolt in the history of the Roman Empire and the third Jewish revolt in 70 years called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. And ironically, irony of ironies, the Romans decided here, we're going to end you on every level, Jews. We've had enough of you rebelling. You're the most difficult people to deal with in our empire. So we're going to destroy you as a nation, destroy you as a religion. We're going to go after you both ways. We're going to ban your religion, basically. You can't teach your Torah. And we're going to destroy your national identity by renaming your country, which we used to call Judea, Roman province of Judea, after the Judah. You know, the Jews come from Judah. The tribe was a kingdom of Judea in the land of Israel. We're going to change that to Syro-Palestina, because Israel is considered part of Greater Syria in terms of Roman Empire, which was a much larger area of territory. But let's think about it. It's like rubbing in your face. We're going to take the people who were your nemesis going back a long time ago, who no longer exist, and we're going to rename the country after them. It's sort of like in your face. We're going to rename every town a non-Jewish name, which is why
Tiberias, Nablus is Nablus. All of these Roman names for cities in the land.
Well, Tiberias actually named by Herod Antipas, who was the grandson of Herod the Great, in honor of the Roman Emperor Tiberius, and that was before this time, by the way. But a place like Nablus was really Shechem, which is the biblical city mentioned in the Bible, which is named Naples. Irony of ironies, Arabs don't have a P sound, so instead of calling it Naples, it's Nablus. That's why Banyas is Banyas up north and not Panyas, named after the Greek god. But fast forward to the 1960s, when the Arab-Israeli conflict becomes one of those micro conflicts, not really micro, but proxy wars between the Soviet Union and the United States, with the Russians now backing the Soviets, now backing the Arabs, and America backing Israel. So they create this notion of a Palestinian identity. The PLO was created in 1964, a few years before the 67 war. Ahmed Zukeri, it was done by the KGB through the Romanian secret police, by the way. And I could show you multiple quotes of today would be Palestinian Arabs saying there's no such thing as Palestine. We're Arabs.
And I seem to remember there was a piece of that story with the KGB where they were asserting to the Palestinians, please stop talking about killing Jews. If you want the Western hearts and pocketbooks on your side, you need to start referring to Israel as colonizers and that they've stolen your land, and that is the way you will win the media war. Is that a correct... is that correct?
I'm not sure of that particular case, but it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. I'm not sure of that particular case, but it could very well be because they're smart, the Soviets, and they've succeeded. It's now succeeded, the hearts and the minds. But what we have to understand is, A, the Arabs are the colonizers. You know, the Jews are in the land of Israel for 1,900 years before Omar ibn al-Khattab, who is the second successor to Muhammad, also his father-in-law, the second caliph, brings the Arab armies to what's today Israel. And then, yes, it's true. Different Islamic dynasties, all of which hate each other and fight amongst each other. Umayyads, Abbasids, Ayyubids, Mamluks, Seljuks, Ottomans. Some of them are not Arab. They're all Muslim. Like, you know, the Ottomans, who ruled for longer than almost anyone for 400 years, are Muslims, but not Arabs, will rule the Middle East, conquering it from each other. It's not like there was just the, so they show up. The colonizers are the Arabs. And the land of Israel always had a mixed population for the last 2,000 years of different groups of people. Once the Arabs come in, they will add to the mixture. But there, before that, there are, you know, Christian populations living in the Middle East and different peoples from left over from different civilizations. But there's always Jews there. So that's like such an important thing. But the other side of it is to understand that the Arab Islamic animus towards the Jews is really old. It predates anything to do with the birth of the modern state of Israel. It's in the Quran. We could do a whole class. We don't have time to go into it now. But the Islamic attitude towards non-Muslims in general and Jews specifically is they're supposed to be dhimmi, subjugated people who have to know their place. And there have been explosions of anti-Semitic violence in the Arab world and also in the land of Israel. So it's not something new at all. You know, in the anti-Jewish riots of 1929, triggered by the Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj al-Amin al-Husseini, who the British put into power to be the chief religious authority in Jerusalem, and then became an ally of Adolf Hitler and raised a Bosnian SS unit to kill Jews in the Balkans. What are they screaming during the riot, which was triggered by the fake news that the Jews are trying to destroy the Gold Dome? Yet again, they're still using that story. They're screaming, Palestine aduna wa Yehud kalbuna. Palestine is our land and the Jews are our dogs. You know, so this is not, that's the battle cry way before. This is 40 years before, you know, 40 years before we have anything post 1967 in occupation or anything like that. So it's just a level. There's so much misinformation floating around there. But the Jews, we are a people, we're indigenous. And also Jews come in all size, shapes and colors. Israel is about 40% Middle Eastern Jews, Sephardim, some of whom are as darker than any Arabs. So the kind of the intersectional idea that Jews are somehow religion, they're white, they're European, and they're put there out of residual guilt for the Holocaust by Europeans who also had no right to the land, who also colonized it. The British, who were the people, actually the last people in the land of Israel before the state of Israel, were merely the people who conquered the land from the Turks, who conquered the land from the people who came before them, who were the Mamluks, who conquered the land from the Ayyubids, who conquered the land from the Crusaders, who conquered the land.
So it's an unending story, but it's much more complex. The British were occupying. And when the British left, it went back to the indigenous people that were there, which is why they offered a partition plan between the Arabs and the Jews, who were the indigenous people to the land. Is that correct?
I mean, the Arabs are less indigenous, but the British, you know, say these are the peoples who are here now. The Jewish population increased dramatically late 19th, early 20th century. But the British mandate and the, you know, was originally supposed to give to the Jewish people all of what is today Israel and all of what is today Jordan. And the British, as soon as early 1920s, they lop off 75% of that territory and create a country called Transjordan and give it to, you know, they had to pay off a guy by the name of Hussein, who was one of the religious leaders of Mecca, for his help in World War One. So they give it to his son, basically. You know, so they take 75%, give it to the Arabs. The remaining 25%, they're going to subdivide into Jewish Arab states. And of course, we know the history of that is the Arabs reject that UN vote, November 29th, 1947. The Jews accept it. So we have to go back to the beginning before there was any occupation. I could say this till I'm blue in the face. It's never been about the issue of occupation. It's never been about creating a Arab state, call it Palestine or whatever you want to call it. It's always been about the Arab world's inability to accept a Jewish state of any size. So these are facts that people just don't want to hear. They just want to buy into because they're not doing the research. They're watching TikTok and Instagram and they're getting fed this narrative that poor indigenous brown skin people are yet again being subjugated by white imperialists.
Right. And I think, like you said, if it's going by the color of your skin, there are many white Arab Palestinians and there are many dark skinned brown Jews. And it doesn't, you know, if you go and look in Israel and in any of that area, you will see people of lots of different sizes, colors, shapes. And it would be very hard to tell a lot of the time who's a Jew and who's an Arab.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the next question I think is really coming up a lot, which I'm seeing out here. I'm not sure if you're hearing this so much in Israel, is this big question of the word that they are using, which is proportionality. We know Obama came out and gave this ridiculous interview where he basically talked about proportionality, even though he himself flattened Mosul with zero regard for any civilians in that area when they were wiping out ISIS. But when we talk about proportionality, and people get very hung up on, you know, how many people are being killed, and the more people that are killed, the more righteous their cause is. What is proportionality? How do we understand this concept, and how does it apply right now to what Israel is doing?
Right. So, first of all, when they give statistics, you have to understand what they're announcing about how many people are dead is coming from the Palestinian, the Hamas, you know, minister of health. You know, he's saying that there's 10,000 people dead and 3,000 of them are children. First of all, you have to assume that they're lying through their teeth, number one.
Right. So
number
questioning
two, you have to
assume
they're
important.
Also counting. Right. And they're also not distinguishing between combatants and non-combatants. Like if we killed 2,000 Hamas fighters, they're gonna get, those are the casualties. Proportionality has nothing to do with how many people die fighting. That has nothing to do. It's never used anywhere else in the world. If you use proportionality as that means whoever loses more people is always in the right. I mean, more Germans died than Americans or British soldiers in World War II. You know, like that's the way, this is the way it always works. And, you know, in wars, it's not about how many people are killed. Proportionality deals solely, and this is the actual, in terms of international law, with the level of response to a threat. So people say, okay, but you're killing thousands of civilians. No, that's not it. The example I heard that's a great example illustrating this is if you have a sniper in a building and he's shooting at your troops, to blow up that building, even though there might be civilians in it, would be a proportional response. Okay, even though there might be some civilians in the building also because your troops are under fire and they're using that building for cover. A disproportionate response would be to level four city blocks around the sniper because he's in the building. Okay. So that's disproportionality. And this is exactly what Israel is doing the opposite of. As a matter of fact, we're suffering a ridiculous number of casualties precisely because we're not willing to level whole areas of Gaza and drop bunker buster bombs everywhere, which even, by the way, if the hostages were down below, we wouldn't do it. Because we, the Israeli army, this is the fact, it's not debatable, behaves with a level of restraint and humanity unlike any other army in the world. And no other army would do what we do. No other army, you know, like sending
it's interesting. I heard an example the other day of in Gaza City, they were holding this big screening party in the middle of the city. Where all like, you know, thousands and thousands of Palestinians were gathering in the middle of Gaza City to watch movies that were being projected on the sides of the government buildings. And I think they were screening some of the stuff that Hamas put out of all the terrible things they did to Jews. I'm not sure if that's true, but apparently there were thousands of them coming to watch these movies. And somebody said, like, Israel knew they were doing that. If they really wanted to kill a bunch of citizens, all they had to do was drop a bunch of bunker buster bombs on those thousands of civilians all congregated together. And they would have done the job if that was the job they were trying to do. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, the whole thing, the genocide thing drives me nuts. We're terrible at genocide. The Arab population, the Palestinian population just keeps going up. I mean,
worst genocide.
If Israel,
ever.
No, seriously, we suck at genocide. But the problem is when you use these words over and over again, it just belittles them to the point where they don't have any meaning anymore. So it's a complete not used. The only people guilty, and Israel is guilty of war crimes. No, I'm sorry. I'm not an international jurisprudence expert, but I know for a fact that the only people guilty of war crimes are Hamas. There's no cycle of violence. They started this. There was a ceasefire in place before October 7th. If they hadn't done anything, Israel had done nothing back. By the way, Hamas is not a prison. It's not occupied. Israel has this. All these things that are thrown around, these terms. Israel hasn't been there since 2005. We expelled Jews from Gaza and gave it to them. they're the ones who took it from a very nice place and to make it into just a missile launching site. That's why the walls were built around, because every country's first responsibility is the safety of their citizens' population. Anyone who says otherwise is just full of it. I'm sorry. So Israel builds this to protect them, but there's always been an exit from Gaza through Egypt on the Rafah crossing in the Sinai that Egypt keeps closed. Why is no one protesting about Egypt blocking them in there? You know, Israel wouldn't be blockading them, wouldn't have destroyed the airport in Gaza and wouldn't have had maintained a maritime blockade around Gaza if they'd been normal, nice place. But if we did it, we know what happened. There's no question, no debate. They would just bring in more and more and more weapons. As is, Hamas dug up all the sewage lines and water lines and cut up the pipes to make missiles.
Right.
Hamas is the one who initiated the conflict. Hamas not only targets civilians with missiles and slaughtered 1,400 Jews, but is using their own population as human shields. There's no debating any of this. There's no debate. There's no case to make otherwise. If Hamas were to say, okay, we surrender, then everything stops immediately. Israel would not keep leveling Gaza. We have no desire to do it. It's all such lies and obfuscation of truth. It is so incredibly annoying. And the problem is Hamas knows, they know how to play the left. They know to play the media. They know to play the sensitive left-wing students to get the sympathy, because of the world will all just say, guys, Israel's defending itself and has a right to respond because you represent an existential threat to Israel. You already demonstrated that on October 7th. Right. And if you don't believe that, look at Hamas's charter. It calls for the destruction of the state of Israel. It calls for the murder of Jews. It is a homicidal, genocidal movement. That's terrorist.
I think what people are struggling with is what I hear sometimes from people are, yes, of course, it should be that the Jews should be expelled from their land because they're not supposed to be there anyways. And I think that is one of the underlying, because if you ask people what they mean when they say from the river to the sea, if they really answer that question and you say what parts of Israel, of Palestine are occupied, and they say all of it, what they're saying is they want it free from Jews, all of it, everywhere. And I think the difficulty sometimes we're running into is this understanding that people have that, well, Jews aren't supposed to be there anyways, so what's the problem? And that's where I think indigeneity comes into the question. And certainly that is how the news media is supporting how they report it. Do we do with university students, news media, and places that are talking about it as if, well, if the Jews get kicked out or eradicated, they weren't supposed to be there in the first place?
Well, I'm pretty sure that in Islamic worldview, bottom line, this is mainstream Islam, you know, a piece of real estate that becomes Islamic, even if Jews were the indigenous population, from their worldview, is not allowed to go back to being non-Islamic. It was, as a whole discussion we could have on the Islamic worldview of conquering what is viewed as an imperative to physically conquer the world. So I'm sure there are people who believe that, okay, maybe it was Jewish at some point, but now it's not. And it's not allowed to go back to being that. It goes against the way the Muslims view the world. But then again, they have so rewritten their history in the last few decades to deny there was ever a temple in Jerusalem, for instance. I could show you 23 years ago, Muslim websites talking about where the Gold Dome stands was the site of Solomon's temple, and also the site of where Muhammad ascends to heaven, a story that's connected with the site literally 600 years after the second temple was destroyed in Jerusalem. So, and I can even show you the guidebook printed by the Mufti, that guy we mentioned before, the Adolf Hitler, sycophantic lover of Hitler and hater of Jews. In his guidebook, it says this site is beyond dispute the site of Solomon's temple. So they've rewritten their own history. So what now, I think a lot of these people have been so poisoned by hate, the Arab population, the Palestinian population, that they actually, a lot of them probably really do believe. They're also being like useful idiots. They don't really know what's going on either, but they're believing that Israel's illegitimate, that there's a genocide going on, that the Jews were never there. It's all made up, that, you know, it's the big lie that Dr. Goebbels was talking about in World War II. Say something ridiculous, repeat it loud enough and long enough, will people start believing it. As far as their allies,
which is a great description of the internet, alliance. By the way, like that's basically how the internet works. It's a great description of the internet, right? Like say it loud enough and long enough, and then everybody will believe it, is basically how the internet works.
And show a lot of images of some of which are, by the way, fake or repeated or used from different places. Let's show a Syrian chemical weapon attack going back 10 years ago. And this is showed, and with people with like, they're gassed, they have no physical signs of, you know, and we'll say those are Jews just killed, or let's throw out, you know, Mark Twain had a great line. This is way before internet, you know, BC, before cell phones. He said, a lie gets around the world before truth has time to tie its shoes. So that fake story about the hospital being bombed, you know, Rashida Tlaiba, that horrible congresswoman who's a Palestinian, who's an anti-Semite, she still refuses to retract it. We know, you can see, it's beyond any doubt, it was a misfire of one of the 30% of the missiles that land in Gaza, probably shot from a school or a UN facility, that landed in a parking lot and maybe killed 50 people. In fact, he was being horrible, was killed. But to announce that Israel just bombed a hospital and killed 1,000 people, and immediately everyone just accepts like everything that comes out of it's because on some level they really want to accept it. But I think that a lot of these university students, even in top schools, just because you go to a good school doesn't mean you're really smart. I mean, you might have raw intelligence, but you're pretty stupid. If you ask them what from the river to the sea means, they probably have no idea what it means. If you showed them a map of the Mediterranean, the Middle East, they probably can't even point out Israel. They can't point out Gaza. They don't know what it means from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, which is a call for the destruction of the Jewish state. Just say it because it sounds good. You know, it rhymes from the river to the sea. Palestine will be free.
Yeah, and this is great. I mean, everything needs to be in short, cool clips. And, you know, from the river to the sea sounds very cool, but they don't. I think the people who do understand what it means are super problematic, and they are clear about this. I mean, we saw this in the debates recently on Oxford and Cambridge with Ben Shapiro. You know, that those who understand what it means, if you push hard enough, they will eventually say there should be no Jews in Israel, period. But for those who don't understand it, they're just repeating the line. They don't really understand that what they're saying is that they want Yudin Frey, you know, land in the Middle East. So, and I think you're right about this idea that just because you go to a great university doesn't mean you're smart, because we definitely saw the miserable performance of those students at Cambridge and Oxford, which are supposed to be the biggest and the brightest, and the idiocy that's coming out of Harvard, that clearly critical thinking and, you know, intellectual honesty are not the values that are being upheld in any of those institutions anymore.
Yeah. And by the way, I hate, but I respect that people are at least honest. Occasionally people say the quiet part out loud. I just saw on TV, I don't think he was an Arab. I think he was a Pakistani, but he was living in Canada. I don't know where, maybe Toronto. And he's talking about how, we are going to take you over too. They're honest about it. This is Islamic worldview. They believe that it's their destiny to, I'm not saying all Muslims are jihadi people. Many of them are moderate and nice. They're the ones who don't open their mouths because they're afraid of being killed by the radical ones. But the street, the universities have been taken over by extremists who are either just bought into the lies, or really, because even without the lies and the untruths about Jews being foreign white occupiers, still it is not an Islamic worldview to have a piece of real estate in the middle of the Arab Middle East, which they ethnically cleansed of all their Jewish population, which, by the way, in many places like Iraq was there like 1,000 years before there were any Arabs in Iraq. There were Jews living in Iraq from the Babylonian Empire way before there was the Babylonians were not Arabs. So they've already gotten rid of or subjugated all the other minorities living in the Middle East. And now they just want to finish that last little, you know, that sore, you know, that's the Iranians are very honest. They call Israel like a cancer. It has to be like cut out, you know, it has to be gotten rid of. So the scary part, the sad part is that the supposed open accepting, especially on the left people, they just don't want to hear. They got their fingers in their ears. They don't want to hear that part. Even when it's said out loud, I don't want to hear it. No, they're just this intersection. There's another group of oppressed people who are just fighting for their rights. No, they're not. They're genocidal murderers who want to destroy not only the Jewish people in the Jewish state. They want to come after you too, and you're helping them. They must be laughing their heads off seeing how stupid these people are in American universities.
So I have a question.
You know, like Queers for
then.
Palestine.
Right. Like I have a question about that then, because I think one of the parallels that we're starting to put together is Germany in the 1920s and 30s was considered the height of intellectualism, civilization, of a civil, smart, advanced, progressive society. And within, you know, 5 to 10 years, the entire population was going out there and horrifically slaughtering their Jews on a mass scale. You know, which is why the term genocide was coined in the first place. So when we look at American universities, are we seeing historically the same signs that we saw in terms of what was going on in Germany as far as the worldwide population starting to think differently about Jews than they never did before? Or is there a parallel here?
I mean, yes and no. The, you know, Germany, with the question about how Germany was able to, how Hitler could turn, you know, Germany into a one-party totalitarian state, what was arguably the most technologically, democratically, culturally advanced, you know, civilization in the world at the time, right, which, by the way, Jews love more than anywhere else. Jews love German and Austrian culture, Vienna, oh my God, Berlin, oh my God. You know, the quote that's attributed to Hermann Göring, the commander of the Luftwaffe, he didn't actually say it. I have to do some research, but it's very true. He said, fear. If you can get people to be scared enough to get them to do almost anything, but fear is how you get control of them and mold them into one. To go after other people, you have to also work on the hate aspect of it. You have to demonize your enemy. If you can demonize, and Jews have always been demonized. We've been accused of so many ridiculous things, you know, especially in the Christian world, where Jews are guilty of the original sin of the Jewish people is rejecting Jesus and getting him killed. You know, Jews are dangerous people. Look, they got God's son killed. They can do horrible things to you. They can poison wells. They can kidnap your babies, right, use their blood to make matzah, you know. They can control the world's economy. Hitler's saying this, by the way, when he wants to target, because part of the fear thing is you have to create someone to be afraid of. So the left, the brainwashing of the left is the notion that basically European white civilization is evil to the core. It's exploitive. It's racist. You forget the fact that all the values that they're espousing come from European white civilization. You know, liberal democracy is a byproduct of really Judeo-Christian ethics, which is really the Jews. But you gotta basically have an enemy. You got to focus on the enemy because you got to be against something to be able to get that power. And you got to create fear out of it. And that's what's really coming on. So what I'm afraid we're going to start seeing is, you know, right now the you know, Jews are being pulled into the animus. You know, right now the Palestinians, the idea is the poor Palestinians are being destroyed by a mass murdering, genocidal, you know, Israeli Zionist army. But Jews around the world are being pulled into that now and being attacked, because being pro-Israel means you must be part of that, or even being Jewish means you must be part of that. So if you show any sign of your Jewish identity, a mug and David, a kippah, or anything like that, then you're obviously a target because you're part of this. It's a unique thing about, you know, it shows us, by the way, that what Israel bashing is ultimately about is anti-Semitism, because the biggest spikes in anti-Semitism, we're certainly seeing them now, 300% increase in America, 600% increase in England in the last month. It's only because of what's going on in the land of Israel. So it's this toxic combination of misunderstanding, deliberate hate, and ironically, a bunch of people who really are anti-Western, which is the very particularist radical Islamic world, which is literally manipulating the West against itself on university campuses and mainstream media. But none of this would work, Ellie, if it wasn't for a nice fat dose of anti-Semitism under the surface there, that people could always be pulled out of the drawer and used to demonize Jews in general.
I heard Adrian Gold spoke last night at a thing I was at, and she said, like, you know, the Holocaust bought us 70 years of reprieve from people outwardly speaking their anti-Semitism. It became not de rigueur to be a Jew-hating person for about 70 years or so, because the Holocaust was so horrific. And now, you know, the party's over. Like, it's absolutely fashionable to yell gas the Jews in the streets and to carry signs that say clean the world with a mug and David in a garbage can, and to say horrific things about Jews and beat them up in the streets and call them colonizers. Like, it's quite shocking. And I think that's partly where I certainly in the diaspora, and you could speak more to what's happening in Israel, but like the it's not even enough to say the veil has been lifted. It's literally like an ice bucket has been dumped on everyone's head, and we've suddenly woken up the day after October 7th in an absolutely different world than we went to sleep in the day before.
Yeah, 100%. I always, the ice bucket analogy I'm using all the time. We got really an ice bucket thrown in our face. I mean, what's going on in Israel is, you know, the shock of living through something. Where was the army? How could this happen? And it's very personal here in the front line, is only a few miles away. And we realize it's a fight. It's a different reality here. But we also know in Israel, by the way, that we're defending ourselves. We don't have to count on no one's driving caravans full of cars through neighborhoods and yelling anti-Semitic slogans here. That's not going to happen, because this is Jews protecting Jews. There's a tremendous amount of unity now. So the fear here is something different. And in many ways, is less unease. I just came back from South Africa, you know, on that Saturday, where literally cars were driving around. There was cars with masked Jewish private security service with M16s driving in cars and telling us, we stood on the street, said, get off the streets. Don't be on the streets now. Like a small little car with four guys with balaclavas over their faces, just their eyes shown. Each of them 16s, they're driving in a little car and saying, please don't stand on the streets. It's not safe to be out. That's not what's going on in Israel. We know how to deal with terrorism. We've lived through it before, but I think what people are dealing with diaspora is, wow, this is like kind of, we're beginning to experience what Jews went through in Germany in the 1930s, painting swastikas on and being beaten up in the streets and not being safe. And being told not to be outside, showing any, it's like the frog in the water that's slowly being boiled. You know, first when we had secured it outside a synagogue a few years ago, wow, that was, tree of life. Okay. Now it's like you need major police presence everywhere, and they're telling people to avoid. We're slowly sliding into a situation which is what, Europe was like before the Holocaust. I'm not saying it's the exact parallel situation, but
right.
I think it's a big wake-up call for Israel, like 73 was for Jews living in Israel. But it's much more, I think, traumatic on a certain level for people living in diaspora who, it's like post-Holocaust, we got a breathing space of three quarters of a century where, like we talked about that book, you mentioned people like dead Jews, that the death of 6 million Jews bought us a reprieve, but it's been creeping up slowly, the levels of anti-Semitism going up higher and higher and higher. And now it seems like, the mask has been ripped off, and now it's raw and it's out there in the open. And as the conflict goes on, and with the misuse of proportionality, and more videos are shown of more dead Palestinians, and the death toll rises, even if it's mostly fabricated, doesn't include Hamas terrorists, the pressure, the support for Israel is going to start to peel away. Biden has actually held the line pretty well. He's under a lot of attack from the left side of the Democratic Party. And I just think I hate to say it, but I think it's going to get worse. The number of incidents, the actual quality of the attacks. I'm afraid of actual significant physical attacks against Jewish communities in diaspora. I'm not afraid from here. We'll finish with Hamas here. But it's really getting back. The line is being drawn in the sand over one big issue. Who's going to live in truth and reality and who's not?
Right.
Because, it's the most unambiguous conflict since World War II. Yet it's like this. It's like December 8th, 1941, the day after Pearl Harbor, there's some sort of pro-Japan rally in at Sydney Opera House or something like that, or in New York. That's what's going on, literally. Like people have lost it because the internet and the flow of information that's unfiltered, people have lost the ability to distinguish what's right and wrong. People say you can't even do that. Those are your facts. What's true and false, what's right and wrong, what's good and evil. And when you cannot do that, the world is basically dividing up between a lot of useful idiots who really don't know what they know, but are siding because of other reasons like intersectionality into a worldview that is really supporting evil and actually enabling evil. And the greatest evil that faces the world today is radical Islam. There's no question in my mind that is the greatest danger to not just the Jewish people in Israel, but to the world. Is radicalized Islam is the number one source of most terrorism and violence. And yet they're getting help from people who they actually are on those people's hit list. And it's all because we don't know how to live with truth and reality anymore. And that's the real struggle. A person has to make the decision that even if I'm comfortable with my beliefs, I want to know what's true. And there is a way of getting to those facts. If I make a decision, I want to find them out for sure.
Okay, so I think where we're going to try to, bring this all together, when we started today we talked about this idea of myths and facts. And what you're pointing to now is this question of what's truth. And I think this is a big part of what everyone is struggling with, both in the diaspora and in Israel, maybe more so in the diaspora, is there is just tidal waves of information. And it's very hard to tell what's truth and what's not. And we consistently, even for ourselves as Jews, question, well, maybe I don't know the truth. What is the truth of this situation? So as a historian and also as a Jew, how do we relate to truth? How do we parse truth? How do we figure out what the truth is? And then how do we stand by that?
Okay, that's a really good question. I mean, the first thing a person has to do is make a decision that they want to know truth and they're going to question things. And number two is you got to invest time. Everyone's so ADD, you know, you cannot get the Middle East on a 30-second Instagram clip or a TikTok video. And someone is showing an image. We have to distinguish between pictures and the power of images versus information and facts. And the reality is even if you don't go to a library, and no one goes to a library anymore, I found I do this all the time. Okay, you know, search engines have algorithms and they can be, you know, they talk about how TikTok is deliberately, the Chinese are deliberately manipulating their algorithms to show 5-to-1 content that's pro Hamas and whatever. But still, if you go, for instance, you go to Google and you say, what does the Hamas charter say? You'll see it says it has right there. It actually, there's the trick is, I think, really to start looking for information as opposed to following certain people that just give you, you know, confirmation bias. Like, right. I don't listen to these people. I don't listen to those people because they tell me what I want to hear because that's what I believe and I don't want to change. So the real struggle that we have to make, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, you know, my Rosh Yeshiva, the guy who turned me onto Judaism and founded Eish HaTorah, he had a couple of quotes. He was very into this. He used to always say, the battle for life is the battle for sanity and clarity or death. You have to be clear, but you first have to make a decision that you want to live with truth regardless of the consequences. That's what greatness is about. Even if it means losing money, going against what you invested your time in, that's called cognitive dissonance in psychology. Or, God forbid, going against my peer group or what's acceptable on a university campus because everyone has to be intersectional and use the right pronouns. And that's just a bunch of sheep or a bunch of lemmings. They're all going to go off a cliff. Because they could be actually taught things that are antithetical to reality. One thing I know as a historian is that only principles, be they in science or in government or in economics, that are true actually work. It doesn't work. Like communism, I love it. I really want it all to get along and everyone shares and no one has more and fine, but human nature works a certain way. And unless you incentivize people and reward them for their efforts, it don't work. Like that quote that's always this, you know, attributed to Einstein, the definition of insanity is repeating the same experiment over and over again, expecting a different result. He actually didn't say that, but it's very true. Let me drop my pen a million times and see if eventually one day I let go and it flies up. No, like don't jump off the roof thinking, man, one day you'll violate the laws of gravity. So it's about commitment to truth. What Einstein did say, by the way, it's one of my favorite quotes, is he said, what's the difference between genius and stupidity? He said, genius has limits. Stupidity doesn't seem to have limits, which is why people who can be very raw, be in excellent Ivy League school with actually raw IQ that is very high, you know, intelligence is highly overrated if you're not into truth.
Right.
The commitment. I know some people who are not super well educated, maybe not the highest IQ, but they're much more down to earth, grounded, sane people than some people. So that we make the mistake of like kind of, you know, blending those two things together.
Right. There was a lot of very smart Nazis, right? Intelligence doesn't determine morality by any means.
Right. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the highest concentration of PhDs in the German army was in the death head squad of the Waffen SS, those 3,000 elite mass murderers, because it takes ideologically, we should never conflate culture, education, technology with truth and right and wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes the Nazis didn't want crazy, you know, death metal skinhead, you know, tattooed people in there. They wanted ideologically motivated people, which is the other point is you have to learn to take what people say as their ideology, as what they really believe, even if it's not what you want to hear from them. That's the other big problem, you know, like the Arab world is being, the radical Islamic world is being much more honest than people want to hear. And very few want to hear, they just don't want to hear, it doesn't fit with my narrative. So this is really the struggle. And I think it's not an accident, Ellie, that it's centering around the Jewish people, because ultimately we brought in, going back to the beginning, Abraham brought in the most radically transformative idea in human history. As an infinite, invisible, all-powerful, all-knowing creator of the universe, when the entire world was worshiping idols. And literally, not only people think he was crazy, but for 2,000 years, from the birth of Abraham to the birth of Christianity, people were constantly telling us we're out of our mind because somehow they thought reality was a popularity contest. You know, it's that great line I'm paraphrasing from 1984, that great anti-utopian novel by George Orwell, one of the last free-thinking, unbrainwashed people says, I'm paraphrasing, not the exact quote, but he said there are truths and there are untruths, and just because you're in a minority of one doesn't make you wrong. And Jews are the people who have always been the most politically incorrect ideology in human history. We've been telling the world right. for thousands of years, you're all wrong. Reality is not a popularity contest. Right and wrong and good and bad are absolute objective criteria that must be applied to the world if you don't want to eat each other alive. And the fact that now we have the most unambiguous conflict since the Holocaust, yet people are, you know, equivocating and going back, it just shows you how lost the world is and how much the world needs the Jewish people, because ultimately we stand for truth. And the ultimate truth, Judaism says, is God. Everything that is true in terms of a principle, a concept, a law, science, all is an emanation of the infinite creator of the universe. And to the extent that we Jews serve as role models for truth, is the extent that the world will get clarity, even though we might have to do a kick, dragging them kicking and screaming towards it. So it fits totally into this kind of end of days scenario of what's going on in the world, when the real battle for life is the battle to live in reality or not. And living in reality means connecting to those absolute values. Otherwise, you're denying them, and you're gonna gravitate towards insanity and evil and incredible destructiveness. So that's why it's not an accident that the world is obsessed with this conflict, that people are so unclear on it. And at the center of it is a people who are 0.2% of the world's population, which is the Jewish people. We've always been at the center. You know, right. And it's also not an accident that despite our teeny tiny size and having no real physical power, although Israel has a pretty decent army nowadays, people have always viewed us as so threatening, because truth, we're always shining the incredibly high vault wattage spotlight on reality. And when people don't like to see that, turn that light off, go after the Jewish people. So, which is good for us, because we should understand, we shouldn't get, yes, it's about radical Islam, the ideology. We should always be able to have the perspective to stand back and see what is really at stake here. Much, much bigger things than Israel's war with Gaza and anti-Semitism. It's about which direction the human race is going to go in. And it's our job to get them there.
Yeah, I'm so happy we're finishing with that, because I definitely think people are feeling, because the Jews will never win the numbers game. You know, we are the smallest of the small. We're one of the smallest religion, if we even call ourselves, we're an ethno-religion, but we're one of the smallest religions on the planet. And the majority of people right now are absolutely watching the BBC and CBC as gospel truth. And it's very crazy making. Like, you literally feel like the entire world is gaslighting you. And it's hard to stand for the truth, which is we are a people who loves, you know, peace and morality and want things to be better for us and for the whole world. And it's really challenging having a constant barrage of millions of people saying that that's not true when we know it is.
Yeah, but like, just to add one more thought, you know, like a lot of Jews who are minimally Jewish, suddenly they're being woken up. They're suddenly realized they're very uncomfortable. Yeah. And this is the silver lining in the cloud is for people to sit back and actually look at, like, what does this mean? Why are they coming after me? Why are they conflating what's going on in Israel with me? It's totally assimilated Jew who has nothing to do with anything, you know, because bottom line is that, like, we have this very unique role to play in the world. And it's a great opportunity to analyze, you know, why, what we stand for as a people. If they're coming after you, or, you know, just to end with a quote from Noah Weinberg again, he said, if you're willing to die for something, then live for it. And you know, the world needs Jews for Judaism. We make the best role models for the planet Earth. And if we don't get humanity back on target, we're going to be in very big trouble. But I always say, Jews, we should always say as Jews, we say it in the morning in the prayer book, Ashreinu matov helkeinu, happy are we, our good is our lot. You know, it may not be always comfortable to be Jewish. And right now it's not comfortable to be Jewish, but we should thank God we were born into, whether we like it or not, it's a responsibility that's bestowed on us. We're born into a people with a unique ability, despite our teeny tiny size, to be so transformative and powerful, which is why evil is so threatened by us, despite our teeny tiny size. But we have the opportunity and the ability to educate and direct and be role models for the world, which doesn't mean to conquer the world or convert. That's not our thing, but just to show the world how to get it right. And we can do it. We've Judaism and Jewish ideas have directly or indirectly transformed the world. And the real cry that's going out now is to get clear as Jews and our allies who want to be on our side and realize that this is the way the world needs to go, to wake up and take the responsibility, take the pain for the gain of being the people whose job it is to really get humanity to move in the right direction on every level. And that's our responsibility. So that's the beauty and the responsibility of being part of this amazing little nation that has so transformed the human race.
Yeah, beautiful. I it also reminds me of something I was thinking about last night, which is, you know, because we'll never win the numbers game, like we won't win on quantity, but if we invest in quality, meaning if we go deeper, understand ourselves more, you know, embrace our Jewish identity and really understand our own history and our own future, then, you know, numbers don't matter if you have a better quality product. And if 100%. You understand what you are. So I think that's something that we're all struggling to do, but, you know, hopefully part of what we're doing together in this podcast is maybe helping to, in some small way, increase the quality of Jews knowing who they are. And like you said, and as Rav Noach said, you know, knowing what we're living for.
Yeah, and just add, well, I keep adding one more thought in there because it's kind of scary to people now. Oh my God, the world's lined against us. Look at these countries. We got, that's why you need to know Jewish history. That's why we do this podcast, because we are the living proof of the supernatural. You know, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister who wasn't even religious, he said, to be a realist as a Jew, you got to believe in miracles. If, you know, everything about Jewish history, the highs and the lows, it's all supernatural. But we've come against very powerful people in the past. Great empires. And they, as Mark Twain said, they either sit in twilight now or vanished. And he says, the Jews saw them all, beat them all. So, you know, we'll outlast these people, but we want to get to the finish line as quickly and painlessly as possible. So that's why we need to now take advantage of this big bucket of water that's been tossed in all of our faces and wake up and rise to that responsibility. And we could do it. Just kind of got some unity and some proactivity. And most importantly, some education would be really useful too.
Yeah.
You got to know it.
And also just to say, for anyone who maybe doesn't have the same context as we do, what we mean is, you know, we survive in order to do our piece of the puzzle to bring the world and humanity to a better place for everybody. This isn't about making everybody Jewish. This is about everybody being empowered to be their best selves. And that Jews are supposed to be one of the mentors and guides on that path towards humanity, living up to its potential in some way.
Beautifully said. Exactly. We don't convert. We don't conquer. It's about being a role model.
Awesome. Amazing. Okay. So lots of stuff in there. Please, again, to anyone listening, please feel free to share this out there. Please be in touch with us if you want us to cover a very particular topic. Again, you can find this podcast on Apple. You can find it on Spotify. You can also find it on both of our websites, and which you can find in the liner notes of this episode. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And if you would like to get in touch with Ken or myself to do, we've done an event with an organization with a city a couple of weeks ago. So if you'd like us to do a live event or you'd like to bring Ken to your city, please be in touch with him and let's get the word out there. Thanks so much, Ken.
Thank you.